Hello there, everyone. I'm Rob, a producer on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 2nd of February, 2022.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity, Beacon Centre. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. Written for us this week, we have myself, Rob, Simon, Peter, Roger, Tanya, Terry, Rob, Steve, and Helen. This week's edition is a special feature edition. We'll be back to our normal service next week. Coming up, we have the quiz questions and quiz answers. We have Roger giving us his Did You Know feature. We get to hear from Helen to find out what's happening at the Beacon Centre. We have a message from the Black Country Living Museum. Pete tells us all about video magnifiers. We find out about TV nostalgia. We have an article on Monet and how he coped with his sight loss during his art career. And we have a book review. We start now with the quiz questions. Hello there, and welcome to this week's Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. What is the name of the church festival held on the 2nd of February? Question 2. What did ancient Romans like to do in February? Question 3. What is February's birth flower? Question 4. What can't ever be seen in February? Question 5. What is the 2nd of February called in America? And question 6. What do snowdrops have to help them through the winter? I will be back to reveal the answers later in the show, but for now, good luck. Up next, we have Helen with this week's Beacon Update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen, back with another Beacon Update. Now, hands up, who's felt like January was forever? Well, if you're anything like me, you'll be pleased to know there's now less than 50 days to go until spring. And I'll tell you, I could not be more glad that we have finally made it into February. I mean, January alone seems like a year in itself, doesn't it? Well, if the sounds of stepping into a new month with some extra pounds in your pocket sounds pretty good, then why not sign up to the Wolves Lottery? As well as being in with a chance of winning £1,000 every week, you'll also be supporting people with sight loss with a donation of 65 pence from every £1 played made to the Beacon Centre. It costs just £1 a week to enter, and you can find out more on our website www.beaconvision.org/support-us/wolves-lottery. It's a bit of a mouthful, so I'll give you that again. www.beaconvision.org/support-us/wolves-lottery. Next this week, when did you last get your eyes tested? If you've got a sight loss condition, hopefully it was fairly recently, but did you know that almost 50% of eye problems can be successfully treated if caught early? If you or someone you love is overdue a test, don't leave it another month. To find your nearest optician, you can head online www.nhs.uk/find-an-optician. Have you visited our eBay store recently? Well, we've got some great Beacon bargains on there. You can pick up everything from a Sega Mega Drive to an Italian lady's scarf. And don't forget, Every purchase helps us support someone with sight loss. Shop now. www.ebay.co.uk/USR/Beacon Charity Shop. That's www.ebay.co.uk/USR/Beacon Charity Shop. And talking about our stores, do you or someone you know want a career in retail? We're really delighted that we've got a number of job placements available at Beacon through the Government Kickstart Scheme, with retail assistant vacancies in our Sedgley, Bilston and Hales Owen stores. If you want to gain real experience and earn a wage at the same time, and you're aged 16 to 24 and in receipt of Universal Credit, contact your job centre work coach to apply. Last week, we were celebrating all things Scottish at Beacon for a traditional Burns Night celebration. Our lifestyle coordinator, Ian, donned his best kilt to address the haggis, and later, with the sound of bagpipes playing, our members cooked haggis and tatties using potatoes grown at our Beacon allotment. I can tell you, they had a lot of fun on that day. Now, last this week, one of the most common problems people come to us with is not being able to read due to sight loss. Whether you want to catch up on the day's news, read a recipe in the kitchen, or write a card to a friend, if your sight loss is stopping you, it can have a huge impact. So we know that for many people, a desktop video magnifier can help. If you'd like to try one, then call Beacon Sight Loss Advisors for an appointment on 01902 880 111. And remember to bring something you struggle to read with you. That's it for this week. Hopefully, I'll be back soon with another update. Bye-bye.
Thank you for that update, Helen. Up now, we have a message from the Black Country Living Museum. The Black Country Living Museum's access tours are back for 2022. And their first tours will be taking place on Saturday the 12th of February. The Black Country Living Museum are excited to be able to welcome visitors back to their specialist tours, as they continue to connect with audiences, particularly those from blind and deaf communities. Each month they will be hosting an audio descriptive and British Sign Language interpreted tour. On Saturday the 12th of February, their Loving the Black Country Access Tour explores objects in the museum's collection that share stories of love and courtship. Their collection includes handwritten love letters, wedding attire and sweetheart pincushions made by British soldiers in World War I. These pretty embroidered gifts were sent to their sweethearts back home. Places on the tour can be booked either via their website or with their sales and ticketing team on 0121 520 8054. That number again, 0121 520 8054. Lines are open between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday to Friday. The audio descriptive tour takes place between 10:30 a.m. and 12 p.m. Please note that all places must be booked in advance. Up now, we hear from Pete, who has for us a piece all about video magnifiers and how they may be of benefit to you.
If you're struggling with reading and need a magnifier, have you ever considered a video magnifier, or sometimes known as a digital magnifier? Well, Beacon have a range of video magnifiers that you can come in and try. Now, a video magnifier, you can increase or decrease the magnification, so you can turn it up a bit or you can turn it up quite a lot to help you read. You can change contrast settings on a video magnifier, so you can look at something in true color, or you could change the contrast to black on white, or white on black, or yellow on black, or black on yellow. It's whatever works best for you, so there's a range of combinations there that you can try to find the right one. You can also freeze images on a video magnifier. So let's say there's something in your fridge, a piece of some food. You could take a little picture, because the angle's a bit difficult to read, of it, and then bring the magnifier away and then zoom it up. So if it's something like the sell-by dates or ingredients on food, you can read it comfortably there. So video magnifiers range from small handheld magnifiers you can sit comfortably in an armchair to read with, up to medium-sized ones, which are about the size of laptops, and then there's desktop magnifiers with big, large 24-inch screens, which really make magnification strong. So if you would like to try a video magnifier to see if that would help you, You're very welcome to. Just call Beacon's Sight Loss Advisors for an appointment. And remember, bring something you struggle to read with you. So if you'd like to try a video magnifier, give us a call on 01902 880 111 and ask for a Sight Loss Advisor. 01902 880 111.
Thank you for that information, Pete. Now we hear from Flashback Roger and his Did You Know section.
Hello, everybody. Well, with January out of the way and my New Year's resolutions well and truly scuppered, it's time to move on and look forward to some warmer, sunnier weather, although that's still a while away yet, isn't it? Anyway, so for now I'll just say, did you know that? As this is the first one in February, it's worth saying that this day, the 2nd of February, is Candlemas. It's now a date in the Christian calendar that had its origins back in Roman times, when a candlelit procession was held to honour the deity Februa. It's the date of Candlemas, and it also marks the date halfway between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. The word February comes from the Latin Februum, when ancient Romans held a spring cleaning festival. Also, February is one of the most misspelt words in the English language. The second month of the year is the only month when there isn't ever a full moon. And whenever it's a leap year, anyone born on the 29th of the month is called a leapling, whose birthstone is amethyst and whose birth flower is the primrose. Groundhog Day is also on the 2nd of February in America and Canada. And it's so called, but it's said that should a groundhog appear from its burrow where it's been overwintering and sees its own shadow cast by the sun on a clear day, then it will retreat and shelter for another 4 weeks until it considers that the winter has properly passed. Snowdrops, or galanthus, to use their Latin name, generally start to appear in February and mark the coming of warmer weather, but are sometimes seen earlier. The plant is often considered to be a British plant, but there are no records of it before the 1700s. So it's more likely to be either an accidental import or by way of an ornamental plant collector bringing it in from abroad. And snowdrops have antifreeze proteins that help inhibit ice crystals forming, protecting the plant cells from damage. Snowdrop leaves have specially hardened tips to help them break through the frozen soil. These are essential qualities for plants that grow and flower at the end of winter. There are 20 native varieties and more cultivated ones too, with names like Grumpy, Robin Hood and Octopussy. Well, how about that then? Who'd have thought it? I don't know about you, but I'm sure I could do with a bit of that antifreeze protein on these cold mornings. Never mind, I'll just have to make do with me porridge and thick jumper. In road up. Till next week, I'm off. I'll have a nice mug of hot chocolate and make sure me long johns are made for in the morning. So, bye for now. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra!
Some great facts there, Roger, as always. Now we have a piece all about the world of TV nostalgia, read to us by Steve.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
A world of nostalgia. From a Watford garden shed, Talking Pictures TV counts the Queen among its million-strong fan base for classic films. We all love an old movie at Christmas, and it seems the rest of the year too. And this is written by Sylvia Kent. Who's laughed at the silly antics of Laurel and Hardy in films such as Busy Bodies, Way Out West, or Saps at Sea? Presumably, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. A fan of the comic duo, she has probably watched these movie gems courtesy of Talking Pictures Television, of which she is said to be a regular viewer. Being well informed, she probably also knows that the channel is operated from what is essentially a garden shed in Watford by film fanatics Noel Cronin, his daughter Sarah, and son-in-law Neil. Launched in May 2015, their free-to-air vintage film and nostalgia television channel initially aired on Sky. It then also became available on Freeview, Freesat, Virgin, and Uview. TPTV is now aired 24 hours a day, reaching weekly peak viewing figures of 6 million. Where does this thirst for old movie magic come from? The British public certainly used to enjoy the Saturday morning pictures. Here they delighted in watching swashbucklers and supermen clashing, plus westerns and weepies, all for the cost of sixpence. To the delight of folk who witnessed films firsthand in the old cinemas, they can now relish the prospect of seeing replays on their own screens at home. But it's not all oldies. According to the Internet Movie Database, there is also a cult following for vintage films amongst younger generations, fascinated with the fashions, cars, music, and of course, the stars of yesteryear. Thanks to Talking Pictures and Noel's passion for old and often obscure films, for the first time, viewers were able to enjoy a myriad of mainly older black and white British films, both classics and B-movies. As time went by, the TPTV schedule also included some American films, straight-to-video programs, and cinema shorts. Movie aficionados in pursuit of lost films were delighted, as were those fans of classic TV series, as episodes of Boyd QC were added by TPTV, alongside No Hiding Place, The Hidden Truth, Secret Army, A Family at War, and scores of other favourites, including Rumpole of the Bailey. The Cronins are particularly well placed to run the channel. Noel and Sarah know the film industry well. Dad started off in 1963 as a postboy with the Rank organisation, later moving on to assist in the cutting rooms, Sarah explains. He eventually became an editor at the Central Office of Information, working with directors who went on to become famous in their own right. After his work in film distribution, he started Dandelion Films, followed by Renown Films, which bought up the rights of many British films during the 1990s, distributing them to terrestrial channels. This was at a time when these old libraries of films, reels in canisters, were just gathering dust, with satellite channels not interested in them, Noel says. Sarah's career is also fascinating. She was a freelance foreign correspondent with special expertise in Africa, and a producer, director, and photographer who appeared in films as well as making them. She has been nominated twice for a Royal Television Award for her documentaries. With her strong family background in film and television, she naturally began working with her father in his business. She says, "We sold films to the major broadcasters for many years, but then demand for the type of films in which we specialise started to decline. But we knew there was still a sizable audience for them. Dad began licensing films for DVD release. With orders flooding in, it was obvious that people were thrilled to find movies they hadn't seen in years. This was the spark that set the Cronins on the path to creating their own TV channel. A rocky road awaited. Sarah says it took faith and self-investment. They tried writing several business plans to secure investment, but there was little interest in putting money forward for a channel that focused on black and white films. There was no budget for advertising, but by using social media to attract publicity, they gained traction in the early morning slots when most channels were still showing teleshopping. An odd quirk of fate happened in lockdown. While many businesses struggled, TPTV found a new audience when furloughed viewers switched on in the morning and continued watching all day. A warm comfort blanket is how Sarah describes it. Their vintage channel became news, and the Cronins were delighted when their output was covered in the national press. Now, alongside the Queen, fans of the channel include Vic Reeves, Mark Gatiss, Hayley Mills, and Danny Baker. As a historian, it's been fascinating studying the rise of this channel's success, not just with the older generation, but unexpectedly with younger viewers. And there is much to learn from watching some of the remarkable old films, particularly linked to history and literature. It's also fun, when viewing some of TPTV's earliest films, to spot actors in their often small debut roles. Many, like Dirk Bogarde, Michael Caine, Joan Collins, Judi Dench, and so many more reached the acting heights from these early films. So how does it all work? Sarah explains. Noel schedules the day's programming, and the day-to-day mechanics of running the channel is from our home. Films are always bought as part of a package from large archives. Our work is carried out by specialists, but everything else is done in-house, quite literally, as our company is run from our garden shed. Noel reckons that choosing what to buy is first based on suitability for the channel, then price. A single library package can cost £200,000 or more. While focused on the film and TV of yesteryear, this is a business thinking ahead. The Cronins aim to refresh titles so that they air individual films no more than 3 times a year. And while British black and white films are their main focus, they also anticipate showing older TV documentaries and shows, screening both classic American films and productions in colour. While streaming giants like Netflix and Disney have helped create a new golden age of TV, in just 6 years, from its humble setting, not far from many of the heart studios that made classics of yesteryear, Talking Pictures TV has tapped into our love of nostalgia. Talking Pictures TV can be viewed free-to-air on Virgin 445, Freeview 81, Sky Channel 328, Freesat 306, and UView 81. See talkingpicturestv.co.uk for schedules. And Talking Pictures TV is all one word. Renowned Films classic DVD packages can be purchased at renownedfilms.co.uk. And again, Renowned Films is all one word.
TNS Soundings.
Cheers for that, Steve. Now we hear from Tanya, who talks to us all about Monet, the famous artist, who had sight loss and how that affected his career.
Claude Monet is one of the most well-known of the Impressionist group of painters of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. As a group of artists, the Impressionists tried to represent the elusive quality of light on natural objects such as water and trees by using dabs or strokes of primary colour. At the time, this was a new and innovative style of painting and a great contrast to the period of realism that had preceded it. Whereas realism portrayed objects and people as they appeared in real life, Impressionists created elusive and sometimes blurry images. This led to suggestions that the artists may be short-sighted. However, it's true that Claude Monet did have problems with his eyesight later in life, first being diagnosed with cataracts in 1912. For a decade, he refused cataract surgery, being concerned that his colour vision would be affected, but over the years he became increasingly frustrated and eventually agreed to surgery. By comparing some of Monet's paintings of the same scene, for example the Japanese bridge at Giverny, painted initially in 1899 and then again after he had developed cataract, it's possible to appreciate the difficulties he encountered in clarity of perception, colour and detail, and the effect the progression of his visual impairment was having on his painting. Monet was born in 1840 in Paris, and his family later moved to Le Havre. His father was a wholesaler and chandler who hoped his son would join him in the business. His mother was a singer and a talented musician who died when Monet was 16. Monet was more interested in becoming an artist than working with his father. Whilst at Le Havre Secondary School for Arts, he began producing charcoal caricatures which he would sell in a local shop. The shopkeeper introduced him to the artist Eugène Budin, who began mentoring Monet and, in particular, teaching him how to paint en plein air, outdoors. Budin was one of the first landscape painters to paint outdoors rather than in a studio. This was a pivotal relationship, and it developed in Monet a love of the play of light on natural forms such as trees and water. Monet acknowledged the influence Budin had on him as an artist, saying, "If I have become a painter, it is entirely due to Eugène Budin. They were to remain good friends with mutual respect for each other's art." In 1861, Monet was drafted into the army and went to serve in North Africa, where he contracted typhoid. His aunt, with whom he lived following the death of his mother, managed to secure his return home after he became ill, but made it conditional on him studying art with Charles Glaire. Glaire was an artist and a teacher whose students included other impressionists such as Renoir and Sisley. This was a very important part of Monet's painting career, as he met and studied with other artists who were to become part of the emerging Impressionist movement. He also met and had a relationship with Camille Doncieux, who was one of Glaire's models. They had a son together in 1867 and married in 1870. Monet's family did not approve of this relationship, and his financial state was precarious as a little-known painter with the responsibility of providing for his young family. Although he was beginning to achieve recognition as an artist, the French art establishment was not enthusiastic about his style of painting, deriding it as having vulgar colours and appearing unfinished. This was a very difficult and personally challenging period for Monet, leading him to attempt suicide in 1868 by jumping into the River Seine. It was Doncieux who helped him to recover both physically and mentally, although he continued to suffer from depression during his life. Doncieux was the model in many of his paintings, including Camille on the Beach in Trouville, painted whilst on their honeymoon, and La Femme à la Robe Verte, which brought him recognition within the art world. In 1870, Monet and his family travelled to England to escape the Franco-Prussian War. Although they stayed for only a short time, Monet became interested in the work of contemporary English artists such as Constable and Turner. The following year, the family moved to the Netherlands and then returned to France in 1871. The Impressionists were seen as a radical movement, embracing a different approach to painting with less traditional themes and more reference to contemporary life. Their work was often rejected by the Salon de Paris, which was the official art exhibition of the Académie des Beaux-Arts. This led to them forming the Anonymous Society of Painters, Sculptors and Engravers, and holding the first Impressionist exhibition in 1874. It's been suggested that it was Monet who first coined the phrase Impressionism with his painting at the exhibition called Impression Sunrise. However, Monet continued to struggle to achieve success, sometimes selling his paintings for as little as 200 francs. He faced further challenges and sadness in his life when his wife died in 1879, shortly after the birth of their second son. She was aged only 32. Monet became depressed once again, but took refuge in painting with a renewed determination to be successful. Monet's personal life was complicated. He was friends with Ernest Ochède, a department store magnate and art collector who went bankrupt. After the bankruptcy, Ernest and his wife Alice lived with Monet and Camille, and Monet began a relationship with Alice. Following the deaths of Camille and Ernest, Monet and Alice married in 1892. Alice was said to be so jealous of Monet's first wife that she insisted he destroy all photos and letters of her. Only one photograph is thought to have survived. Monet and Alice moved to the house in Giverny, now a place of pilgrimage for his fans, which attracts 500,000 tourists a year. It was here that Monet was to paint his most famous paintings. In his mid-60s, whilst living at Giverny, Monet began to perceive colours as being less intense and vibrant, and he was diagnosed with nuclear cataracts in 1912, but he refused surgery. His paintings between 1918 and 1922 demonstrate the impact his eye condition had on his paintings. His work appeared to become increasingly abstract, using large brushstrokes and primary yellow and red tones, but little blue. He complained that the reds had become muddy and dull, and became unhappy with his painting, saying that his eyesight was making him see everything in a complete fog, and he destroyed many paintings. His friend Georges Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister, described this, saying, Monet would attack his canvases when he was angry, and his anger was born of dissatisfaction with his work. Monet destroyed canvases in his quest for perfection. Monet sought advice from ophthalmologist Richard Liebreich, who was very interested in art and had written about the effect eye disease had on artists such as Turner. He advised cataract surgery, but Monet refused until he was 82, when he eventually agreed to surgery on both eyes. He had been diagnosed as blind the year before. It suggested that following surgery there can be an increased perception of ultraviolet light, which is otherwise invisible, and this may have led to Monet's paintings looking quite different following the treatment. By 1925, Monet was satisfied with his work, saying that he was happily seeing everything again. He died the following year, 1926, at the age of 86.
Thank you for that, Tanya. Very interesting. Now we have the quiz answers. Hello, and here are your answers for this week's February-themed flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. What is the name of the church festival held on the 2nd of February? And the answer? Candlemas. Question 2. What did ancient Romans like to do in February? And the answer? Spring cleaning. Question 3. What is February's birth flower? And the answer? It's primrose. Question 4. What can't ever be seen in February? And the answer to this one is a full moon. Question 5. What is the 2nd of February called in America? And this, of course, is Groundhog Day. And finally, question 6. What do snowdrops have to help them through the winter? And the answer? Well, it's antifreeze proteins. How did you do? Great, I hope. But if not, there's always another chance to have a go next week. Now, to end this week's feature edition of the Black Country Talking News, we hear from Rob and Terry, who have for us a book review.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
I'm delighted to welcome to the studio Terry Prince, who has come in a couple of times to talk about books that he enjoyed very much, or the old classic in one case that he remembers from a long time ago. Terry, you've chosen another book, which is interesting because it's historical, but it's very contemporary at the same time. Tell me why you chose this particular book, which of course is called Munich.
By Robert Harris. And the reason I chose it, I guess, is because I enjoyed very, very much two previous books of his where he uses the same technique of combining historical fact with imaginative fiction. Those two were An Officer and a Spy, which was about the Dreyfus case in France, and Enigma, which was based around the Bletchley Park codebreakers. In Munich, it's based around the meeting in Munich between Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister at the time, and Hitler, the German Chancellor. This meeting took place in September 1938. You have Chamberlain flying across from Britain to Munich, and Hitler in training down from Berlin to Munich to meet and discuss something which was partly a result of how the First World War signing off treaties were done. A large part of Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland was predominantly German, and Hitler argued that that should be given back to Germany.
The Nazis never liked the agreement at the end of the First World War, and yep, it was, looking back, it was an unwise way of doing things and the reparations that came with it. And the Sudetenland had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, of course, and then at the end of the First World War, that was divvied up into different countries. And so the creation of Czechoslovakia, which had never existed before, and so that was easy for Hitler to turn and say, well, actually, that should be in Germany. He'd already got Austria by now, hadn't he? He'd created the Austrian and German link through the Anschluss, through taking over without fighting. Mm-hmm. And now he wanted the Sudetenland. Question is, was that where he's going to stop?
Listeners might think, well, he'd given it all away. But this is the fascination of the book. We all know how it ended with that famous piece of paper that Chamberlain held aloft when he came back to Britain and declared we now have peace in our time. Well, we all know that we did not have peace in our time. So you might well ask, why bother to read the novel? And the answer is, it's a novel. It's not a piece of historical fact. And what Harris so brilliantly does, I think, is introduce into this his three characters, three star characters, as it were, who he operates alongside the historical feature characters like Chamberlain and Mussolini makes an appearance, and also the French representative, Daladier, and of course, Hitler himself. And he makes this mix, which results in a page-turner. It reminded me in many ways of, well, his previous novels. We knew how the Dreyfus affair was going to end. We knew about the Enigma. And in Frederick Forsyth's book, The Day of the Jackal, we knew that de Gaulle wasn't, in fact, going to be assassinated. But we still kept reading them because this blend was so skillfully done.
As a book, as an audio book, I mean, we call it a page turner because we start from the page, as it were. But if you're listening to it, you can't stop listening to it.
Do not think you would be reading a dry piece of historical documentation. You won't, because you will get engrossed with the two characters. On the British side, we have Hugh Leggett, who is one of Chamberlain's private secretaries. That's a good move on Harris's part because it means his central character can be appearing in all the key meetings, etc., and thus feed us with the information we need. While he was at Oxford, Leggett made friends with a German called Paul Hartmann, and he has become a German diplomat as a member of the ruling party, but also, and this adds another flavour to the novel, a member of the anti-Hitler resistance that was beginning to build, which we also know didn't succeed, but we want to know. We want to know what. Right. The book is full of what ifs, I think, yes. Rob, as yes. well, isn't it? Yes. What if the resistance to Hitler had triumphed? What if Chamberlain had taken a different path?
And of course, he's picking on something else that is actually historically true, which is that pre-war, a lot of English and German young people didn't know each other. There had been a great deal of movement around Europe. A lot of students like that. The younger generation at that time actually did have friends in other countries. Therefore, when war broke out between the two countries, it was often war between friends. And that's quite interesting in this, is these two men knew each other. And there's a third person as well that they both knew.
They knew each other as friends at Oxford. And later, they knew a German called Lena, who was, in the first place, the girlfriend of Paul Hartmann, and a very vocal, outspoken opponent of Hitler's plans and methods of action, and in a startlingly vivid piece in the novel, of his private life as well.
We'll come to that in a minute. Let's come to back to Hugh Leggett first, because the book begins with him. It's quite difficult because the mix at the beginning, isn't it? In one sense, he's waiting for something to happen or somebody to come in, but he also mixes up. But tell me about that.
Yeah, I think this opening three pages is absolutely brilliant. In a sense, they're the essence of what Harris does. So you're given a setting in a restaurant in London. You meet this character called Hugh Leggett, who Harris has made up. He's a fictional character who is reading from the newspaper of that day.
I am grateful to Mr. Chamberlain for all his efforts, and I have assured him that the German people want nothing but peace. I have further assured him, and I emphasize it now, that when this problem is solved, Germany has no more territorial problems in Europe. Leggett took out his fountain pen and underlined the passage, and then did the same with another earlier reference to the Anglo-German naval agreement. Such an agreement is only morally justified if both nations promise one another solemnly never to wage war against one another again. Germany has this will. Let us all hope that those who are of the same will gain the upper hand among the British people. He put aside the paper and checked his pocket watch. It was characteristic of him not to carry the time on his wrist, like most men of his age, but rather on the end of a chain. He was only 28, yet seemed older, his face pale, his manner grave, his suit dark. He had made the reservation a fortnight ago, before the crisis had blown up. Now he felt guilty. He would give her another 5 minutes, then he would have to leave.
So he's reading chunks of reportage of what will be going on in Munich, the English position on that, and the developing build-up between the meeting of these two powers, England and Germany. At the same time, you get a hint that all is not well in Leggett's own private life. All is not well with his marriage. It's not giving anything away to say that.
Finally, she noticed him, smiled and waved and moved towards him, cutting quickly between the tables in her tight skirt and tailored silk jacket, leaving a wake of turned heads. She kissed him firmly on the mouth. She was slightly out of breath. Sorry, sorry, sorry. It doesn't matter. I only just arrived. Over the past 12 months, he had learned not to ask where she had been. As well as her handbag, she was carrying a small cardboard box. She placed it on the table in front of him and pulled off her gloves. "I thought we agreed no presents." He lifted the lid. A black rubber skull, a metal snout, and the vacant glassy eye sockets of a gas mask stared back up at him. He recoiled. "I took the children for a fitting. Apparently I'm to put theirs on first. That will test one's maternal devotion, don't you think?" She lit a cigarette. "Could I have a drink? I'm parched." He signalled to the waiter. "Only a half bottle? I have to work this afternoon." "Of course you do. I wasn't sure you'd even show." "I ought not to have done, to be honest. I tried to call, but you weren't at home." "Well, now you know where I was. A perfectly innocent explanation." She smiled and leaned towards him. They clinked glasses. "Happy anniversary, darling."
So you're immediately involved in the historical realities of the text and the fictional as well.
You described the position of Hugh Leggett. He's close to Chamberlain. He doesn't know him very well. And a lot of things he discovers himself about Chamberlain, that the characteristics of Chamberlain, the physical movements of Chamberlain, all this comes through quite interestingly because we've seen it on film. We see certain shots of him, but he does always seem to be a terribly sort of Edwardian stiff character. So Harris plays around with these characteristics and develops them for us, and we see it through Leggett's eyes. Meanwhile, over in Germany, Leggett's student friend Paul Hartmann is himself in a slightly different situation, isn't he? Because it's now several years since Hitler's taken over, 33, we're now into 38, 5 years of Nazi rule in Germany. You don't argue much with that. And yet, Hartmann's got something else going on, hasn't he?
Yeah. Hartmann is very near the centre of power, the Nazi centre of power, has to tread very, very carefully. He's constantly looking over his shoulder, he's walking on eggshells most of the time, and part of the reason of that is because he's involved with a group who are forming together to bring about Hitler's downfall. We're going to hear an extract where some of the plotters are laying their cards on the table, which itself was a dangerous thing to do because the guy across the table from you may not have been wholly committed to your cause. There was fear and suspicion and mistrust everywhere.
Hartmann took his opportunity to speak. "Actually, I can show you the latest proof that Hitler wants war." He reached into his inside pocket and pulled out the text of Hitler's letter to Chamberlain. "This is the Führer's response to the British, sent to London earlier tonight." He handed the telegram to Oster, then sat back and lit a cigarette and watched as the letter was passed around. Kort said, "How did you get hold of this?" "I had to take it from the Reich Chancellery to the British Embassy. I made a copy." "That was quick work." "Well, this settles it, gentlemen," said Oster when he had finished reading. "There's not a hint of compromise anywhere in it." Beck said, "It's tantamount to a declaration of war."
We know that plots against Hitler, sadly, failed. Again, we're caught in this fascinating kind of situation. We're totally engaged in how Harris takes us by the hand and leads us through these events.
Hartmann, your view? "If you want my advice, you should kill the whole filthy lot of them. Himmler, Goebbels, Goering, the entire criminal gang." The violence in his voice surprised him. His fists were clenched. He stopped, conscious of Oster staring at him. "My dear Hartmann, usually so detached and ironical. Who knew you carried such hate?"
One of the things I found fascinating, and I've not read a biography of Chamberlain, I know very little about him, other than the famous newsreel bits, you know, the piece of paper and what have you, I found the depiction of that man absolutely convincing. And the workings of the diplomacy in the government at the time and the tricky path that they had to tread, perhaps in a more gentlemanly way. But earlier when we were talking, you mentioned the role of Churchill in this, for example.
There's a point in here where it says, "I don't want Churchill involved. I don't want Churchill here. Don't let Churchill know." Because, of course, Churchill was a threat, yeah. Always a fear that he was going to come in and take over, which, of course, he eventually did. There's arguments about Chamberlain, and I'm not a historian, but I do recall that whereas many historians have said, well, he was desperate to avoid war, and that comes through very clearly here. Others have said that he didn't know quite how to play a dictator because we're not terribly good English people at understanding how you play a dictator because they're psychopaths or they're sociopaths. So you can't really work it out. Now, other people said, well, actually, he was playing for time. He wasn't a fool. He knew what was going on. His concern was that we were not rearming fast enough. And so he was playing for time. He got a year of delay. I don't know if that's true. I don't know which story is true. But there certainly have been these arguments. I think Harris is very clear. Here's a man who doesn't want war. After all, he is of a generation which saw the First World War. The whole country has been through that agony. The whole of Europe has been through that, and America, everywhere else. And he doesn't want that to happen again.
And I found that, as I said before, totally convincing. Within the structure of the novel.
Exactly. Because it's not a book, it's a novel.
That has to be made clear. Some of the listeners may have seen The Darkest Hour, the recent film. That certainly impacts on what you've just said about how he was perceived by Chamberlain, this novel. But the more I think about it, the more satisfying as a whole it is. He's made a living out of this combination of historical fact and fiction, and most successfully.
Because he was a journalist. I forget where he began, but I know he ended up as a political editor of The Observer, and he was also on another newspaper as well. He knew how to write in a disciplined way, because journalism has got usually fairly tight space to work in, and he knew how to research, he knew how to move at speed, and I think his Fatherland was his first book, and he said at that point he could give up the day job, buy a house off the millions of copies of Fatherland that were sold, and all he's done since is write his fiction and talk about it. It's a skill to be able to take a situation, you think, well, in the case of Munich, we know it all, we've seen it on the films, we know what's going on, and yet we haven't seen it all, because he fictionalises these within this novel. Another one we're talking about, the Conclave, which of course is about the election of a new pope. And you think, as you said, well, how can you make a story out of that?
Well, to put it very crudely, a locked room full of old men deciding who's going to be the next pope. I mean, I hope nobody will be offended by that. They're more than old men, obviously. They're prelates. They're high up in the Catholic Church. I had to stop myself turning to the last page to find out who got the job, quite frankly. He's carved out a niche for himself. I don't think he's become lazy about it. It's not just formulaic. He has a formula, yes, but everything I've read of his, The Officer and the Spy, particularly Fatherland, The Enigma, and the one you've just mentioned, Conclave, have been very rich and rewarding reading experiences.
We've talked about two of the principal characters, and we've mentioned the third one, the girl, Layla. Hartman knew her. They were in a relationship. She's got something about her, hasn't she? She's a feisty one.
She's a very feisty young lady. As I said, she's very outspoken. Her behaviour at this meeting that Hitler addresses eventually lands her in trouble. That doesn't put her off. She continues to resist and to vocalise her resistance. And the last meeting we have of her is a very, very painful one. We move from this energetic, vital, outspoken young lady, Hartman's girlfriend, and legates, perhaps?
Okay, that's right. We mustn't go into too much detail, but that is
painful
quite
to
that's
read,
right.
Yeah.
Again, it makes sense within the context in which Harris is writing, because you were either broken by fear that you lived under. You were either broken by that, or you survived it somehow, and there's an argument as different ways in which you can survive it. But on the way, she's a feisty young woman who's got a very strong view to it, and she's willing to express it.
Indeed.
Hitler glanced over at the small throng. He must have heard. The stormtroopers certainly had. Their heads had all swung in their direction, but just to make sure, she repeated it. You fucked your niece, you murderer! His face was expressionless. As he climbed into his car, a couple of the SA men broke ranks and started coming towards her. They had short truncheons. Hartman grabbed Lena's arm and pulled her after him. The woman who had told her to shut her filthy mouth tried to block their path. Leggett pushed her out of the way. A man, a big fellow, her husband presumably, swung a punch and caught Leggett just below the eye. The three of them ran out of the square and down a leafy residential road. Hartman and Lena were in front. Leggett could hear the boots of the brown shirts thumping on the cobbles very close behind. His eye was stinging and already beginning to close. His lungs were searing as if they had been pumped full of liquid ice.
We don't want to give away anything, but we can't. There's nothing we can give away. We know that Chamberlain, you know, argues with his cabinet, argues with his military, and keeps going back to Hitler to find a solution that will defer, and he's happy to hand over the Sudetenland, after all, it is a far-off country of which we know little. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something similar to that. And that has resonances now. One can again think of other countries that are sort of dismissed as being, well, why do we bother with that? But the end of the story is no. tone, and yet Harris brings it alive, doesn't he?
You know, the only way it could have been more engaging was if he'd stepped off the plane and said, well, actually, I'm going to tear this piece of paper in half. No, he actually says what he's reported as saying. It's the way Harris describes it. And, of course, we are there standing alongside Hugh Leggett and seeing the whole event through his eyes. So Harris is allowed to employ all his skills as a writer in order to colour this famous moment that we all know, where he holds his piece of paper in the hand and believes that he has sued successfully for peace in our time.
I want to thank the British people for what they have done.
The crowd cheered again. Someone shouted, what you have done? Another called out, good old Chamberlain!
Next, I want to say that the settlement of the Czechoslovak problem, which has been achieved, is, in my view, only a prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler, and here is a paper which bears his name upon it, as well as mine.
It brings together what has been a real clash for Leggett and Hartmann and, in the background, Lena, to go through this experience to square their conscience, their duty to their countries and their responsibilities and their love for each other. And that's all kind of brought together. I should never see that newsreel item in the same way again. I should be looking for Hugh Leggett in the background somewhere, you know.
Thank you very much, Terry.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Well, my thanks to Terry for sharing his thoughts on that novel. Thanks also to Caliber Audio for allowing us to use those extracts from the audiobook. Caliber is a specialist charity providing audiobooks of all sorts and sizes to those who, for reasons of serious sight loss or for some other cause, are unable to read the printed copy. You can find out more about them at caliber.org.uk. The reader on this audiobook was David Rintoul, and the audio version runs for 9.5 hours.
TNS Soundings.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who, without their support, we would be unable to run this free service. Please note, the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!